You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Times of the Sign. The Hollywood Sign began its life, fittingly enough, as a flashy billboard, no more permanent than a film set. In the 100 years since, it has been rebuilt, rebranded, and reborn as a beacon for aspiring stars from around the world, and a reminder of just how few dreams of fame and fortune come true. By Mark Seal. With opening photograph by Dan Winters, which is a vintage photo of the Hollywood Sign. You are surrounded by 45-foot-tall white letters, so close you cannot discern what they say. 1,400 feet above the City of Dreams, you can see the sweep of the metropolis from the hills to the sea, and within it the cauldron of struggle and strife that is Los Angeles. But the eyes down below are staring at you, for you are atop the town's most famous monument, the ultimate symbol of fame, fortune, and the fantasy of movie-making worldwide. You are standing atop the Hollywood Sign. You are not supposed to be here. Normally you would be chased away, fined, and possibly even arrested. For the sign may be the only monument in the world that keeps visitors out instead of welcoming them in. Getting to the sign is almost as tough as breaking into Hollywood, and almost as treacherous, a vertical climb that requires nerves, tenacity, and, like everything in this town, connections. But to understand its significance and its story, you have to start, like everyone who has gazed upon it and dreamed of stardom, not at the top, but at the bottom. Next photo, location, location, location. Originally conceived as a billboard for a Tony New real estate development called Hollywoodland, the sign was built out of telephone poles and sheet metal. Those who know how to get to the sign don't tell, and those who tell don't know. We don't particularly promote this, Diana Wright says of the drive she's about to take you on. Wright is on the team that handles PR for the Hollywood Sign Trust, an organization of 9 men and women, some appointed by the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce. The trust mission, she says, is to preserve and promote the Hollywood Sign as a symbol of hopes and dreams and international filmmaking. Early one summer morning, she picks you up in her dusty Nissan at the gateway to the sign, Beechwood Canyon, a quaint hamlet whose cafe was made famous by Harry Styles in his 2019 song, Falling. She asks you not to reveal her secret route, which would be next to impossible for a neophyte to navigate. The warning signs begin almost immediately, erected over the years by the city and residents fed up with the pilgrims traipsing across their lawns and disturbing their peace. No access to the Hollywood sign, reads the favorite, which seems to adorn every street corner. Park closed. Caution, rattlesnakes in area. There are coyotes, gray foxes, bobcats, and until recently a mountain lion, the famous P-22, which prowled the area around the sign until his death last year. Some say the rabid tourists are the most dangerous creatures of all. For the tourist, it's not about viewing the Hollywood sign, it's about viewing themselves with the Hollywood sign in their photos, says Anne-Marie Johnson, an actor whose extensive screen credits range from In Living Color to Grey's Anatomy. A second-generation Angeleno, Johnson understands the sign's appeal all too well. She remembers an old episode of I Love Lucy, where Lucille Ball stands on a hotel room balcony and gazes directly at it. It stuck in my brain how important it was for Lucy to be near the Hollywood sign, which represented her constant desire to be in the business, just like everyone else. Over time, the sign evolved from the Dream Factory's weather-beaten emblem into an ultra-commercialized global tourist destination that's a nightmare for the neighbors. It's being used as a billboard for things like the Los Angeles Rams football team. The Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce transformed the sign with panels to say Rams House. I believe it's a slippery slope. Can anyone advertise if they have the money? Says Johnson. If you speak to the residents who live below it, you'll get an earful of how their lives have been disrupted. But you aren't here to police, patrol, criticize, or debate. You're here to celebrate this icon, which turns 100 this year. It first blinked to life, illuminated by thousands of light bulbs, in 1923. To kick off the sign's centennial year, the Hollywood Sign Trust recently announced that a visitor center will at long last be built to offer a close-up experience of the monument, though when it will open and where it will be have yet to be determined. Your guide, Wright, grew up in L.A. and long ago internalized the sign's cardinal rule, admire from a respectable distance. She is so devoted to burnishing its image that she carries a can of white paint and a brush in her trunk for small patch jobs. Today, she is going to take you all the way up onto the ridge where the sign stands on Mount Lee, named for the pioneering L.A. entrepreneur Don Lee, who sold Cadillacs and owned a radio station whose tower stood on the peak. Once at the summit, she'll hand you a rope and show you how to access the magical letters on the hill. But first, the drive. I think of going to the sign as the ultimate VIP experience because it's closed off. Not even celebrities can come up here, she says. It's really the people that want to support and protect Hollywood and believe in the sign and the park and the mission. Along the way, you see a woman gazing up at the letters, her eyes closed and her arms outstretched, as if praying toward Mecca. And you meet Azanti Williams, a TV production coordinator, who says she has a secret route to get behind the sign, where she regularly hikes to celebrate the realization of her lifelong dream of moving to Hollywood and launching a life here. It's like, wow, I've finally made it. I'm working in the industry. I'm living in Hollywood. Far below, on Hollywood Boulevard, tourists are lining up to pay $199 to ride to Lake Hollywood Park, one of the favorite but distant public viewing points, in a Ferrari or Lamborghini. The proprietor of this thriving tour business is John Gaben, a crepe maker from France who moved to L.A. in 2001 to open restaurants. Soon, he began hiking up to view the sign and dreaming up ways to build a business around it. People want to see glamour, he says. They want to see movie stars. They want to see the Hollywood sign. And I only saw people doing it in a big, ugly bus. So I was like, let's do it in a glamour way, in Ferraris and Lamborghinis. His company, I Ride Like a Star, was born. It's just the symbol that highlights the Hollywood industry, a young woman stammers, attempting to explain why she and a friend are climbing into a Ferrari for a 30-minute ride to the sign. Like when I think of Hollywood, the sign pops up in my mind, so that's why I want to do it. But when their brief time in those $250,000 Italian luxury cars is up, the windblown tourists are back on foot on Hollywood Boulevard, under the sign's unblinking gaze. For some, it must surely seem to be laughing. For something so huge, the sign is impressively elusive. The intrepid souls who brave the elements and rattlesnakes to clamber directly up the hillside trails toward the sign itself are turned away by two gruff voices from the sky, the two cops at the top. There are police stationed up at the top of Mount Lee, 24 hours a day to kick people off, says Wright. Do you want to see a security cage? She stops her Nissan at a cage filled with security devices. This is where we have the cameras, infrared motion sensors, and a two-way radio system to deter people from climbing to see the sign. The majority of people are just curious tourists who might have gotten lost. But every once in a while, we get someone who likes to go rogue. Several rogues are scurrying across the hillsides now, evading the security cameras and even the police, but not the eagle eyes of Diana Wright. "Excuse me," she shouts from her car window. "You are trespassing. You in the white shirt. Turn around. You're in a closed area." The trespasser turns around and descends obediently, but others are even higher, racing up the hillsides, determined to somehow get to the sign. "I'm going to call the cops on her," Wright says, of one brazen interloper. A siren, followed by a loud voice from on high, suddenly fills the hillsides. "You are trespassing," a cop's amplified voice declares. "There is no hiking on the trail. Walk back down the same road. You're in a fire district area. Thank you." They turn around and retreat, but they'll be back in ever greater numbers and with even fiercer determination to touch the untouchable, all believing they can somehow make it theirs. Say you're an aspiring actor, or a tourist, a business person, or just a traveler passing through. Whatever your objective, you long for a touchstone, something that announces and celebrates your arrival. In New York, it's the Statue of Liberty. In San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge. In Paris, the Eiffel Tower. All accessible, embraceable, inclusive public monuments. In Los Angeles, it's just a word, the name of the nebulous neighborhood it looks down upon. 9 white letters splayed out in a slightly crooked but somehow majestic formation on a hill. Its birth is a happy accident, a testament to serendipity in the city where, to borrow the title of Sandra Singh Loh's 1996 collection of essays, Depth Takes a Holiday, built out of a conglomeration of telephone poles and sheet metal, the sign isn't meant to last 2 years, but somehow endures for a century. The only monument in the world that started out as a billboard. As Hope Anderson, director of the documentary Under the Hollywood Sign, once put it, to understand its beginnings, you have to go back to the early 1920s, to a Los Angeles then, as now, swarming with dreamers and schemers from all corners of the earth. "Don't try to break into the movies in Hollywood," a Chamber of Commerce newspaper advertisement warns at the beginning of the Roaring Twenties, under a photograph of a mob stampeding an employment agency, all seeking work as movie extras. Out of the 100,000 persons who started at the bottom of the screen's ladder of fame, only 5 reached the top. Around the desperate fame seekers, the city roars, real-life dramas competing with the pyrotechnics on screen. In 1921, the comic star Roscoe Fetty Arbuckle is accused of killing a young actress at a boozy party during Prohibition. He'll eventually be acquitted, but not before his career is ruined. In 1922, the silent film director William Desmond Taylor is found shot in the back. Hollywood's reputation for decadent depravity only grows as the years pass. In 1923, the Edgar Rice Burroughs novel, The Girl from Hollywood, was published, about the horrible things that happened to women there, says Leo Browdy, author of the book The Hollywood Sign, Fantasy and Reality of an American Icon. Also in 1923, Paramount released a movie called Hollywood with a poster of the head of this huge evil man who ironically looks a bit like Harvey Weinstein with the word Hollywood embossed upon his head. His mouth is open, and all these women who are about to get chewed up are heading into this open mouth. Around this time, five city power brokers dream up an exclusive new housing development, high above the hullabaloo, free from the crowds, criminals, and bloodsuckers down below. "Where will you live when the second million has come?" asked an early advertisement, referring to LA's then-booming population. "Will your family enjoy a delightful home in the clean, pure mountain air, with its wonderful climate, broad open spaces, and plenty of elbow room? Or will you live in a dwelling in the flat, uninteresting houses-in-a-row sections of the city, your family's freedom hampered by this maelstrom of human existence?" It was also a place for whites to get away from black and brown people in the inner city, says Browdy. They didn't say it explicitly, but that was the imagery of the advertisements. There was one ad of a young white couple in a roadster driving up out of the city, filled with trolley cars and smog, and up to a shining city on the hill. "Up there, the sun is bright, the streets are clean, and the houses are built right into the hill. The name of this suburban paradise? Hollywoodland." Naturally, the grand opening requires an ad campaign. But the man who conceives it, a 26-year-old Angelino named John D. Roche, never intends to create an icon. According to a 1977 Los Angeles Times article, all he wants is a mock-up for a brochure. He sketches the hillsides, the home sites and equestrian trails, the broad streets and rolling avenues. Then, as an afterthought, he pencils in the development's name, Hollywoodland, across the mountainside above. He takes a sketch to one of the developers, Harry Candler, the all-powerful publisher of the Los Angeles Times. Chandler sees pay dirt in the name and pencil on the hillside. It isn't merely a word to Harry Chandler. It's a sign. He wants it big and blazing so that motorists can see it all the way from Wilshire Boulevard 2 miles away. John Roche goes to work to create the sign. 13 big, bold, no-nonsense white letters, each 45 feet high. No permits, deliberations with planning boards, or environmental reviews are required. "I don't think the word environmentalist was in the dictionary in 1923, Roche will later say. Almost 100 Mexican laborers with mules march up the hillside and dig holes in the rocky terrain. Into the holes go telephone poles, upon which are fastened the sheet metal letters painted white. The cost, $21,000. The sign is lit for the first time on December 8th, 1923. It basks in the glow of 3,720-watt light bulbs. The Hollywoodland sign is believed to be the largest in the world, the Los Angeles Evening Express reports. The denizens of the city below revel in the light show on the hill, the massive letters spelling out first Holly, then Wood, then Land, and finally, after a pause, Hollywoodland, a phantasmagoria so extravagant that a full-time employee, Albert Koth, is hired to change the bulbs that constantly burn out. He works out of a hut behind the first L. The sign, along with the development it advertises, is a smash hit. The lots, costing between $150 and $400 apiece, sell quickly. The grand houses rise, and the residents move in, soon to include actors Humphrey Bogart and Bela Lugosi, the mobster Bugsy Siegel, and business leaders and titans of all stripes. 9 years later, on the night of September 16, 1932, an out-of-work actor will shatter the peace and quiet so dear to Hollywoodland. Her name is Millicent Lillian Entwistle, but she goes by Peg. She is 24, with a flapper's hairdo and a solid stage resume, having appeared opposite the young Bogart. An 18-year-old Betty Davis is said to have told her mother, "I want to be exactly like Peg Entwistle." Now, though, Entwistle is divorced and depressed, either over her lying cat of an ex-husband who deceived her by not revealing his previous marriage and child, or her struggle to replicate her success on the New York stage in the movie business. Her few months in town have been rocky, acting jobs lost or abandoned, movie scenes cut by the National Board of Review, housing troubles, and compounding the indignities, financial woes so deep that she is forced to move in with her Uncle Charles and Aunt Jane at 2434 North Beechwood Drive in Hollywoodland. She tells them she is going to buy a book at the village drugstore. Instead, she may well have walked up Beechwood Drive on the route you are traversing now, past the cute little gingerbread Hollywoodland real estate office, near the house Clark Gable once shared with Carol Lombard, and onto the now forbidden trails leading to the sign. No one will remember seeing her. Not hikers or pedestrians, nor residents. Not even Cuff, the light bulb changer. She borrows his ladder to climb up to the H, then takes her final bow before the City of Angels, leaping from the ladder and rolling down the hillside to her death. 2 days later, a woman calls the LAPD. She says she's found a jacket, a purse, and shoes beneath the Hollywood sign. Then she hangs up, but not before saying she's left the items on the steps outside the Hollywood station. Inside the purse is a note. "I'm afraid I am a coward. I am sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain." Headlines blaze. Actress ends life by jumping off. Sign after failure in movies, read the New York Times. Read the New York Times. Suicide laid to film jinx, adds an L.A. newspaper. It's difficult to separate truth from myth. Did she leap or fall? What was her motivation, considering her prospects for film roles were improving? Legend has it that the very next day, a letter arrived in her uncle's mailbox, offering her a role in a play about a woman driven to suicide, says Wright. However her life ended, Entwistle is elevated in death from tortured actor to legend. The cautionary tale, as Ryan Murphy, who will make a pilgrimage to the Hollywood sign shortly after moving to L.A. in the late 80s, tells OprahMag.com. "There were tours where they would show you which letter she jumped off and how she did it," he'll recall. The second episode of the Netflix series Hollywood, co-created by Murphy, will show Darren Criss, Jeremy Pope, Laura Harrier, David Cornsweet, and Samara Weaving climbing the sign, the ultimate metaphor for acting's ladder of success. Entwistle becomes known as the Hollywood Sign Girl, a ghostly symbol of all Hollywood's failures. Her favorite scent, gardenia, is said to waft on the evening breeze. Maybe she even cursed the sign. By 1939, 7 years after her death, the sign is a ragged wreck. Most of Hollywoodland's lots have sold, and maintenance of the sign has stopped. A torrential rainstorm demolishes the H from which Entwistle leapt. It's supposed to be temporary, a billboard, just sheet metal, and so it gets ripped up, says Browdy. The Recreation and Parks Department considers it a public nuisance and wants to tear the whole thing down. In April 1949, the sign's first savior, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, steps up as caretaker. The word land is excised and restoration begins. The sign will now become a billboard, not merely for homes, but for dreams. It reads simply Hollywood. As the years pass, the sign moves from supporting to starring roles in movies, television, and eventually social media. Maybe you saw it in the opening credits of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, hovering over the young Will Smith as he whistles for a taxi to take him to his new home in Southern California. Or in a season 4 of Seinfeld, mocking Kramer's dreams of fame and fortune after he travels to L.A. and ends up being wrongfully arrested for murder. Or in Quentin Tarantino's comic noir, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, taunting a washed-up television actor, Leonardo DiCaprio, and his stunt double, Brad Pitt, as they try to make sense of the late 60s. The sign beckons as a backdrop for love and lust. In Friends with Benefits, Mila Kunis and Justin Timberlake traverse the sacred ground behind the sign, then sit together on the first O until a cop in a helicopter orders them to get down. In the teen romance, The Kissing Booth, late bloomers L, Joey King, and bad boy Noah, Jacob Elordi, lie naked on the hillside near the sign as the camera sweeps across the magical letters. Directors love to destroy the sign, perhaps in subconscious revenge for their early struggles here. In the disaster movie San Andreas, a monster earthquake levels the Los Angeles landscape, bringing the sign tumbling down. Such a downfall seems unlikely, though, for the sign is eternal, indestructible, forever in the sky and the minds of those inspired by it. Just find the hills, we were told, and you'll know where you are, says Stephen Gyllenhaal, the filmmaker and author who drove out to Los Angeles in the summer of 1978 at age 29. No money, no prospects except hope, which was echoed by the sign. He and his first wife, the screenwriter Naomi Foner, pull into town with their 8-month-old baby, the future actor-director Maggie Gyllenhaal, in the back seat. Their son, the actor Jake Gyllenhaal, will arrive 2 years later. They move into a small house just south of Melrose, almost directly below the sign, he says. After all these years, Gyllenhaal is still transfixed by the sign's contradictions. Sure, there's the Eiffel Tower, the pyramids, Mount Kilimanjaro, the Great Wall of China. But we have our Hollywood sign perched precariously on top of hills that too often catch fire, marketing the magic of storytelling, he says. 9 letters, silly, romantic, tenacious, hopeful, and almost dignified, but not quite. The perfect monument for the place that I proudly call home. For me, it was always the welcome signpost I returned to when I wrapped a film. Home, says 2-time Academy Award winner Jodie Foster, who attended an elementary school directly beneath the sign. The moving business has been my family since I was 3 years old. I've never known anything else. When I park my car off Beechwood and take the palm-lined hike up to the fire trail behind the sign, I'm back in the 70s, back to the Polaroid color of my childhood nostalgia, familiar and bittersweet, just like the sign. Bobby Chance is 18 years old the first time she sees the sign. It's the mid-60s, and she has just arrived from Miami with a 7-year studio contract that will lead to roles in Pajama Party, Beach Blanket Bingo, and other swinging beach flicks. She falls in love with the letters at first sight, and the sign becomes her lucky North Star, spurring her not only to make it in Hollywood, but to inspire others. She becomes a Hollywood acting coach, goading and guiding a multitude of wannabes in hopes of unleashing their potential. That sign stands for dreams, she sighs in her Valley Village home office, whose walls are filled with pictures of celebrities who, she says, passed through or visited her Hollywood actor showcase. Brad Pitt, Jennifer Aniston, Martin Lawrence, Kardashians, and dozens more. You gotta come here with a dream. You can't touch the sign, and you can't touch the dream, but it's always there. She looks skyward, as if staring up at those nine letters on the hill. It's not at eye level. It's always looking down at you and saying, get your shit together or go home to mama. That sign is in your face all the time. And yes, she acknowledges the whole thing is a sham. What is Hollywood? It's a bunch of motels, hotels, and tourist shops. People from all over the world come to Hollywood, thinking they are going to see Scarlett Johansson walking down the street. The whole thing is bullshit. Hollywood is a storefront window with no store. There is no Hollywood. Hollywood only happens when you succeed. But that sign is real. That sign is a global magnetic force for dreamers from all over the world. It's as universal as the Apple logo or the Nike swoosh, the ultimate global symbol of everything these young kids want, fame, fortune, and the keys to a Malibu beach house. Elegance Bratton, the filmmaker, writer, and producer making his narrative fiction debut this year with a semi-autobiographical film, The Inspection, first sees the sign in 2009. Then a Marine corporal visiting a friend at Camp Pendleton in San Diego, he feels the sign calling to him from afar. We can't be this close to Los Angeles without seeing the Hollywood sign, he tells his friend. So they jump into her car and drive 3 hours to Beechwood Canyon. Staring up at the letters, Bratton imagines Marilyn Monroe, Sidney Poitier, Madonna, and so many other icons looking at this concrete, tangible, touchable symbol of Hollywood. He has to get closer. A combat filmmaker, accustomed to rocky terrain, he begins the long climb, evading everything to reach the summit. And here, he reaches out and actually makes contact with the letters, feeling their power. I was just blown away. All I could think about is, how many people who aspired to be in the industry made the same trek that I did? 8 years after actually touching the sign and realizing what's possible, he releases his first short film, Walk for Me. Today, he lives in Beechwood Canyon, right beneath the landmark where it all began. It's like when people go to Mecca, or the Vatican to look at the Virgin Mary, or the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa. Being able to climb up there was an influential experience for me. Next photo, King of the Hill. In 1978, Playboy impresario Hugh Hefner teamed up with actors Vivian Blaine and Rita Hayworth, among others, on a $250,000 effort to save the then-dilapidated sign. For some, getting too close to the sign is like getting too close to the sun. When we were in our backyard, we looked up at this behemoth, says the director and artist Aaron Rose, who lived for 5 tortured years in a mid-century modern house hanging off a cliff directly beneath the sign. It was challenging, one of the largest tourist destinations on the West Coast, but no infrastructure. Strangers walking onto the property to get a photo. Once, our security camera caught 3 girls in a convertible yellow Mustang who pulled into our driveway, took their tops off, and posed in front of the sign. Sometimes he would stare up at it and ask, "Are you my friend or are you my adversary?" As a director, he was in and out of work. When things were going well, the sign seemed to be smiling down on him. Like fate had placed me in that house, at the foot of that monument of Hollywood success, and I loved it, he says. But when he was between jobs, the sign bore down upon him with an unrelenting glare. It took on a human, almost like a godlike personality. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, and I'd sit at the outdoor table in my underwear and stare at it. I would say, "You effing bee." It was like what Dennis Hopper said in Blue Velvet. "Don't look at me! Don't you effing look at me!" He often felt the presence of Peg Entwistle. Maybe they're not jumping off the sign anymore, but that sign still represents all the darkness and sadness that this town has imparted on young, impressionable people. I would look at the sign at 2 a.m. and think about all of the broken dreams. Now you are almost there, riding up the circuitous route, the sign peeking at you around every turn. You think about all of the greats who have gazed upon it, an unfathomable array of talent and tenaciousness, producing and performing in the sign's looming shadow. You remember the icons, as humbled by the sign as the newcomers. In the Baz Luhrmann biopic, Elvis, Austin Butler, playing the king, lounges, lip-curled and determined for a comeback, in the rusty, tattered O of the 1970s sign, telling his crew, "When I first came to Hollywood, I'd come up here and sit for hours." The sign was beautiful then, and now feels as though lots of things are like that these days, broke down, beat up, rotten. In 1978, with the sign once again on the brink of destruction, another savior rose up, Hugh Hefner, the priapic founder of Playboy magazine, an authority on the power of symbols, having turned a drawing of a bow-tied bunny into a globally recognized logo. Hefner spearheaded a $250,000 campaign to save the sign. The amount was oddly equivalent in terms of inflation to the $21,000 the sign originally cost, says Leo Browdy, but it's enough for a renovation so thorough and successful that an engineer will say, "That'll be there when the mountain leaves. It's there for good." And now you are there too, ready at last to see the sign up close. You pass through the fabled gate, whose name you are forbidden to reveal. Once opened, it allows you to access a private road at the top of Mount Lee, where you and Diana Wright will traverse the rocky terrain straight down to the sign. She hands you a rope. "We're going to rappel down to the letters together," she says, holding out the rope for you to grasp as you go slipping and sliding down the steep hillside. At last, you are there, standing amid the letters, reaching out to actually touch them. But from this vantage point, they are too big, too close, mammoth walls of blinding, indecipherable white. Like a movie screen, the sign is best seen from a distance, prettier from far away, fairly ordinary up close, says Jodie Foster. You cast a nervous glance at the terrain below. It's a very long way down, but you have made it to the summit, and like every other fresh-off-the-highway interloper, with the audacity to believe you belong here, you want that photo. "Sunglasses or no?" you ask the keeper of the sign. "It's Hollywood," she replies. "Sunglasses." So you put on your sunglasses and you smile. Will the sign smile back at you, miraculously replacing your vagabond clothes with Oscar gowns and acceptance speech tuxedos? Or will it curse you, standing in smug but silent witness as you are cast to the hinterlands? Whatever your fate, the sign will still be there, blessing the town's winners, mocking its failures, and beckoning a never-ending parade of aspirants with the power of a single word. west of Eden. Out of the fringe right, a new vision of the old frontier is rising, off the grid, back to the land, protecting an American dream that they believe to be their own, by James Pogue, with opening illustration by Brian Stauffer, which shows cowboys riding with rifles raised, bison racing, and they're all going in one direction, while vans are coming toward them in the opposite direction with jets overhead. The buffalo were grazing by the highway on the outskirts of the richest county in the richest country in the history of the world. It was a clear morning in the Tetons, and with binoculars it was possible to see all the way across the valley, known since prehistory as one of the most secure and comfortable little basins in all of the Mountain West, named for one of the first white trappers to winter there, Jackson's Hole. The landscape may have looked like wilderness to the caravanning tourist in $200,000 Sprinter vans, and thousands more in athleisure who now flood Teton County year-round. But it is also a kind of hyper-reality of money. Tens of thousands of acres and hundreds of millions of dollars worth of conservation easements in what may be the world's most unequal political jurisdiction. Above the ospreys and eagles, there was a constant traffic of small jets and private aircraft, humming into and out of a town that has become a modern refuge for people with remote jobs and portfolios fattened by one of history's great asset bubbles, many of them driven to the northern Rockies by a worry or wariness that the rest of America is on its way toward environmental, political, or economic breakdown, or some combination of the above. A couple hours outside Jackson, I met Catherine O'Neill, whose family once owned these mountains. Her great-great-grandfather was John D. Rockefeller, and she worked in Trump's State Department. Now she was living in a modest little house outside of Casper, Wyoming, and was about to have her first child with a home appraiser she'd met after moving there. She isn't hiding out exactly, but like many Americans these days, she has a sense that things are cracking up. Election night, we were talking, kind of joking, she said. At the time, she was living in D.C. I was afraid of being thrown into a concentration camp. I know that sounds crazy. I was with my friends, and I was like, well, we're kind of effed, she said. And they're like, well, let's choose a red state to go take over. And I was like, well, I have a place in Wyoming we can go. She is a proud conservative who views the corporate elite as enemies of America and believes that we're on the cusp of a populist uprising against the brand of transnational capitalism championed by Republicans for most of the last half century. Her politics have marked her, at least to the minds of people who share her worldview, as a bit of a class traitor in their emergent epochal struggle against the entire system. Maybe I'm biased, obviously, she said, but if these organizations were run by people like my grandfather, he was a devout Christian and actually cared about this country and wanted to build this country up, that would be one thing. He literally led the way for this country to be a superpower, she said. And we have seen a 180 now. That's what's interesting with a lot of these executives. They're now trying to, it seems to me, break the country down. O'Neill was the key to understanding all this, according to the former Trump staffer who put us in touch, not because she necessarily possessed any secret knowledge, but because she captured so many of the quiet currents swirling around younger conservative circles these days. Wealthy and well-connected preppers and back-to-the-landers have been moving west, many of them at least tangentially involved in the edgy online realm of thought known as the dissident right. Tech executives and crypto investors are creating secretive groups to help people exit, a term that has taken on almost mystical significance in some circles recently, from our liberal society tech-dominated lives and fraying system. And there are grander plans for whole secessionist movements using crypto and decentralized autonomous organizations to build whole mini-societies, many on the model of what Balaji Srinivasan, the former partner at Andreessen Horowitz, calls a network state. Wyoming recently became the first state in the country to allow DAOs to incorporate as private companies. These ideas used to be at the fringiest fringe of a worldview that sees our basic political battle lines shifting from left-right divisions toward a rebellion against globalization, against the notion that the massive market and tech-driven change that we've been living through really represents progress. But this dissident fringe view has rapidly become mainstream on the right, in part through the dire warnings of a disintegrating global system shared almost nightly on Tucker Carlson Tonight, and, significantly, through coded signifiers broadcast by Republican politicians trying to capitalize on the populist ferment. Most obviously, Ron DeSantis, who gave a speech titled Florida versus Davos to the National Conservatism Conference in September. The United States is a nation that has an economy, not the other way around, he said, and our economy should be geared toward helping our own people. According to this view, the American empire is in danger of fading, weakened by a greedy and insulated oligarchy with more loyalty to their pals in London and Tokyo than to their fellow Americans. The elite have driven regular people into a serf-like existence, putting money above every other source of value or meaning, national interest, local cultures, our long-term financial stability, even the environment. Many young conservatives have suddenly adopted an almost mystical reverence for nature, itself a form of protest against our money and tech-driven world. The result is that now a lot of highly online coastal elites talk in much the same way that backwoods militiamen arming themselves against the New World Order have been for decades, and vice versa. Just before I left for Wyoming, a Substack post by a writer who tweets under the name Disgraced Propagandist, titled There's Gonna Be a War in Montana, went viral. A dozen acquaintances sent it to me, including my editor at Vanity Fair. The writer explicitly linked the anti-globalist analysis to an anger that's been swirling in the American West over the land rush engendered by well-off coastal buyers, which has sent rents and home prices spaceward, forcing people to move away or become homeless. Longtime locals talk about being colonized by a flood of rich liberal newcomers. On one side, you have global interest imputing their values, importing cheaper labor, hollowing out Montana's attractions, and selling them to an international bourgeoisie for maximum profits, went the Post. On the other side, you have the new underclass. Not the friendly Christian country folk of times past, and not cowboy hat Republican rancher dad either. No, these are a new kind of country person. Angry, exasperated, poor, he wrote. This group is acutely aware of just who controls Bozeman and Big Sky and believe that the same people are coming for their territory. And they're right. The Montana-based novelist Walter Kern, who has become a hero in dissident circles, called it immaculate bullshit and suggested it had been written by someone hoping to inflame liberal fears of rural revolt. But it captured a moment. It was the same moment in which Liz Cheney, Wyoming's lone congressional representative, found herself losing her primary race in an election in which her opponents cast her as an almost perfect expression of the kind of elite oligarch with no true local roots or state loyalty. I arrived in Wyoming just in time to attend her concession party. Cheney's father looked on, tight-lipped, standing next to a carefully placed hay bale at stage left, as she conceded at twilight among a small crowd of well-heeled supporters dressed in haute Western finery. She, too, talked openly about civil war, a possibility that more than 40% of Americans still think is likely, even after the midterms produced an outcome that made our politics look surprisingly normal by the eerie standards of today. "This is not a game," she said. "Our nation is barreling once again towards crisis, lawlessness, and violence. America is young in the history of mankind," she said, "and yet we're the oldest democracy in the world. Our survival is not guaranteed." A big mustachioed oil man named Tex McBride, who ran a pro-Cheney super PAC, was watching from the back of the crowd. I asked him what he thought was coming next for America. "My answer's not fit for the record," he said, but he went on anyway. "I think we're effed." The so-called dissident right is a world of thought where categories get scrambled. It shares space with the more buttoned-up politics of the new right, but these days includes a whole range of unlikely allies. The scene, as everyone calls it, is a small, cliquey, and status-obsessed world, where even at parties, people often call each other by their Twitter handles. Extremely wealthy tech types chat on Signal all day with hustling writers and smugly racist bodybuilders and rationalist sex workers. And the simple truth is that many people tend to think America, as we once knew it, is already pretty much gone. "Who even needs a civil war?" one scene fixture texted me recently, "when the institutions are doing such a good job of delegitimizing themselves." This scene was very much on display in Austin, where in July I went to see the premiere of Alex's War, a documentary about Alex Jones. The night before the screening, Futo, a software company started by a founding investor of WhatsApp and dedicated to fighting tech oligopoly, hosted a swank cocktail party on the roof of the downtown Marriott. Curtis Yarvin, the intellectual godfather of the dissident right, and popularizer of the idea that America is not and should not be a functioning democracy, flew in for the screening the next day. In front of him was the former Trump staffer and documentarian Amanda Milius, who was wearing an elaborate white dress and showing off her serpentine Bulgari bangles with emeralds for eyes. In front of her was Ali Alexander, the Stop the Steal organizer, who had, along with Jones himself, helped put on the rally that devolved into the Capitol invasion. Ariel Pink, the chillwave musician who was an indie kingpin before it got out that he'd been at the January 6th rally, he left before anyone breached the Capitol, was there too. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.